and welcome to this IFG live event. My name is Maddie Timotjak. I'm an Associate Director at the Institute for Government. I am delighted to be joined by Dr. Adam Marshall just one day before he steps down as Director General at the British Chambers of Commerce. Adam has been part of the leadership team at the Chambers for almost 12 years and Director General for the last five of those. This is when I make the standard joke that it's just been a quiet time for British businesses then. Adam has been at the helm overseeing the Chamber's response to the EU referendum result during four possible no-deal exits from the EU Single Market and Customs Union, or at least that's my calculation. Feel free to correct me in a minute if you think that's not quite right, before managing the response to the coronavirus pandemic over the last year. Adam, I'm really pleased that we now have an opportunity to discuss what your key takeaways are from the last 5 years, and also looking ahead to the prospects British businesses face over the next year or so, especially in the aftermath of the UK's exit from the EU and as the UK embarks on its post-COVID recovery. So good morning, Adam.
Well, it's great to be here, Maddie. I'm really delighted to do this podcast with you.
Brilliant. Just, you know, a few things to cover then in the next 30 minutes. I'll start with a broad question. I mean, how do you, at this stage, how do you reflect on your experience of navigating British Chambers of Commerce members through what really ended up being 5 years of incredible uncertainty for businesses, first Brexit, then COVID? I mean, what's your sort of reflection on that period of time?
Well, first of all, of course, you're absolutely right to say that there's never been a dull moment during my time at the helm of BCC. You know, I took over when we were in full swing during the referendum campaign. And we were campaigning very hard at that particular point in time for information from both sides. We wanted detail from them. And that requirement for detail, that need for the nitty-gritty has, I think, been there throughout the 5 years that I've been in post. So whether it was navigating through the referendum and its consequences or going through the coronavirus pandemic, it's been about getting into the detail of policy and what those trade-offs then mean for individual businesses all around the country. And we've seen over those years as well just how big decisions being taken have a real-world impact on the ground. I think the most interesting thing for me has been that the relationship between UK business and government over the 5 years, it was important throughout. But that relationship definitely ebbed and flowed many times during the period. Sometimes that was due to events, and sometimes it was due to personalities. So a lot of effort had to go into trying to ensure that the relationship between key business organizations and government was strong and that the channel of communication was there. That was just an extremely important lesson, I think, for the future, really. You want that relationship to be strong throughout. You don't want it to have peaks and troughs. And you want to be able to have civil disagreements with the government of the day without those resulting in some sort of cutoff of communication.
So if we drill down into Brexit, I think it's really interesting what you said about the ebb and flow. And I mean, this is something that the IFG has looked at quite a lot, is sort of how first Theresa May and then Boris Johnson's government sort of approached engaging with businesses around Brexit. And I think your sort of point about the need for detail has definitely, again, been a key theme for sure from our perspective. I mean, if we start with Theresa May's government, I mean, one of the things that we in a report we published last year looked at was this sort of delay in making some quite key decisions within her cabinet in terms of the future relationship with the EU and how that made it much harder for government to prepare. But I'd be interested to sort of hear your perspective on what that was like being sort of on the outside, but also presumably engaging quite a lot with key politicians, like how you fed into that process, but also the sort of challenges of trying to navigate that sort of level of uncertainty.
Well, I think there was a lot of engagement throughout, but with the May government, as with all of the four prime ministers that I've worked through, there are times when the government was both listening and hearing, and there are times when it was only listening.
Yeah.
I never felt like we were unable to put our point across. When you're running a business organization that speaks for 75,000 businesses with 6 million employees across the UK, plus British business communities around the world as well, I think it would be extremely worrying if you couldn't get your point across. The question is whether it resulted then in change. So the best moments were when governments were both listening and hearing and really taking on board the feedback. There were some ministers during my time who were extremely good at that. And you would see the real world considerations we'd be putting forward, whether that was around the trade in goods across borders, for example, during the Brexit process, or the cash flow crisis that firms have faced throughout the COVID pandemic, that's translated into real change. And those were the moments which were very definite highs. The moments which were lows were when you'd say things, you'd say them again, and you'd say them again, and you'd know that on the ground in towns and cities across the country that businesses would be hurting and suffering because of a posture being taken by government, but they didn't take it up thereafter. Those were the hardest moments, I'd say.
And on the sort of representing that many businesses with that many employees, I mean, one of the sort of, I think, some of the sort of falsehoods we sort of overly simplify, I think, a business perspective on Brexit, that, you know, all businesses voted Remain or, you know, wanted to stay part of the single market and customs union and all, you know, all businesses opposed Brexit, whereas we know that that's not quite the case. And I guess I'm wondering that given your role, I mean, that must have been quite challenging to sort of navigate that, or how did you approach navigating the sort of representing those different voices within the community?
Well, I think that's the beauty of Chambers of Commerce and the network of Chambers of Commerce that the BCC represents. We are business diversity in action. We have sole traders who've just started up a digital business in their own home, and we have major corporations employing tens of thousands of people in different parts of the country in membership. We have every sector from manufacturing right on through to agriculture through to services. So diversity was baked in for us from the beginning. I don't think Whitehall necessarily understands that. Business is something in Whitehall that has a capital B at the front of it. It's monolithic. And the question is always asked in the singular, what does business think? Mm-hmm. And I have worked really hard over these last 12 years to try to promote a perspective with civil servants in particular, but also with our political friends at Westminster, to think about business as a diverse group of customers and stakeholders. It's not a single group. It wasn't on Brexit. It hasn't been on COVID over the past year, nor on many, many other issues besides. And the sooner Whitehall takes that on board and segments the business community in order to understand it, the better the policy response is likely to be.
That's really interesting. And I mean, do you feel like, because this is something that's quite interesting, looking at sort of Whitehall departments, for example, obviously you do have the Department for Business, but you also then have departments which represent sectors where there are specific business interests. I'm thinking sort of for DEFRA or maybe DCMS with the entertainment industry. I mean, how have you sort of navigated the different relationships, or have you mainly been engaging with the business department itself? I mean, how have you thought about that approach?
Well, we engage across Whitehall because, in a sense, that's what the BCC exists to do on behalf of our local business communities. But it's not without frustration. One of the things that I liked about the industrial strategy, which now, unfortunately, is no longer in its existing form, was that it articulated challenges and issues that we businesses understand from the demand side. You know, country getting older, changes to mobility. You know, we all understand that. And the idea was to develop an approach that hid the wiring across government departments. Yes, there'd be lots of different agencies and departments involved in that, but we in business and Whitehall and government were all pushing towards the same goal, doing something transformational that helped the country tackle that problem and succeed economically at the same time. I think that's still very much work in progress across the piece. Even this week, I've had to get upset with a government department for raising with them a key policy issue affecting businesses right now around international trade and travel, and being told, oh, that's actually in someone else's departmental responsibilities. If there's one big change to Whitehall culture, I think it's got to be removing those silos and having a single civil service that sees the problem to be solved, or the project team, as something that needs to sit at the heart, because that's where nimble, agile, and really strong policy responses could come from.
No, that's really interesting. And we might come on to the sort of industrial strategy and the sort of replacement of that with the plan for growth and what that means in a moment. But I mean, if we sort of reflect on the fact that, you know, the 1st of January marked a huge change for British businesses trading with the EU when the sort of, you know, the UK left the single market and customs union and the trade and cooperation agreement took effect. I mean, how do you think the end of the transition period has gone for business?
Well, undoubtedly, some of the impacts that we were most concerned about did not materialize because the pandemic drastically reduced volumes of international trade across borders from their normal levels. Chambers of Commerce do a huge amount of work in the international trade space. We help over £20 billion worth of British exports reach their destination every year, for example. So we know what we're talking about when we talk about facilitating trade in goods across borders. You know, we saw falls of 20, 30, and 40% during the pandemic. Some of those carried through the 1st of January. So it wasn't the transition we expected. I think that's the first thing. However, even with that muted trade across borders, we did a survey at the back end of January, 1 month in, which made it clear that 49% of exporters were facing significant difficulty with their EU trade. And that both the volume and the value of their orders from European customers was down massively. And I think that's been borne out by sectoral trade associations' figures to date as well. Now, these problems are from one of two possible sources. One is an adjustment problem. For some businesses, this is a question of figuring out how to deal with new procedures, fill in the paperwork that's required, reduce the unit cost to their business by getting more proficient at it, and then just carrying on. That's some. But for others, this is structural and permanent change that will affect their business model materially and whether or not they can make a profit trading. You know, and some even threatens their very existence. So, you know, we have to say, okay, this is not all teething problems. This is not all adjustment. For some businesses, this is an incredibly fundamental change. There will be losers and they will lose big. And the sooner in Westminster people acknowledge that, yes, this is a big political change which has occurred, there will be winners and there will be losers. We are really sorry that there are losers from this. We don't like to see any of our businesses lose out, but this is the logical consequence of what's happened. And there are winners in those who've been able to adjust quickly or those who were already aimed at markets elsewhere. You know, that's an honest response. Not simply saying it's teething problems, sweep it under the carpet, nothing to see here. Because that's not the truth.
That's really interesting. And I mean, we might take each of them in turn. I mean, on the sort of adjustment problem, I mean, one of the things that I know the IFG consistently talked about, and I mean, this is drawing on work that the British Chambers of Commerce did as well, is that, you know, preparing for the end of the transition period during a pandemic was difficult, and that created problems for business. And I think what I'm kind of interested in is the fact that, you know, around last summer when there was a discussion about whether or not ministers, whether or not the government should extend the transition period, there were sort of reports from papers that ministers were hoping that COVID might disguise some of the Brexit impact. And to my mind, it seems like that has actually borne out to an extent. And I'm wondering, sort of on the two sides, does to an extent the fact that actually the pandemic means, for example, businesses aren't necessarily sending people abroad to deliver services in the same way, they actually have to, that sort of bakes in a bit more time to actually prepare for those changes. Does that help in some, to some extent, buying a bit more time to adjust? Or has the sort of overarching impact of the pandemic, and we will get into the detail of that in a moment as well, has that actually hindered businesses to a greater extent?
Gosh, we have not seen the full impact of the Brexit changes very definitively. You mentioned services there. I think there's going to be a huge amount of surprise when international travel starts up again for business purposes and when there are incidents at various border crossings or questions about whether someone can go to another country in order to provide a particular service. Under the terms of the TCA, and I think that will loom large in the public consciousness, because that will be the first time people will see this change for business travelers, for example. I think that makes all the more urgent simplifying and clarifying and building on the mobility provisions that are in the TCA. Because at the end of the day, I don't think that European businesses would want to see the UK adopt more restrictive mobility provisions. In fact, I think the UK has adopted relatively open ones in comparison with those put on the table both by the EU and many individual member states. But ultimately, that creates collective disadvantage because it means less business will be done between the two. So, you know, I think that is an adjustment still to be seen. I don't think that the pandemic's muting of international trade has made things any easier for businesses, though, and somehow given them magically more time in order to deal with the consequences of the end of the transition period. Because quite frankly, they're fighting a five-alarm fire at home in terms of dealing with the pandemic. And the three-alarm fire of Brexit that's a little ways down the road is going to have to wait until they fix the five-alarm fire they're facing right now and douse those flames. So it's putting one problem and one issue on top of another, really, for most businesses, rather than creating breathing space in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I know that's a nice sort of analogy, really, for us to think about. On the structural and sort of permanent impact that you talked about, and you talked about winners and losers from the Brexit deal, I mean, you sort of talked about Westminster needing to be open about that, which I, you know, agree with. But is there anything specifically, anything more you think the government should be doing to try and support businesses? Or actually, do they just need to say, look, things have changed and accept that there will be losers and sort of let that play out? I mean, how do you think, you know, the government should think about navigating that?
Well, I mean, the very first thing that they should do is to try to settle the UK-EU relationship under the TCA and avoid any further tension arising between the two parties so that that adjustment to the TCA, which is still ongoing on both sides, can in fact happen. I think inflaming the UK-EU trade relationship, whether it's over vaccines, whether it's over Northern Ireland or anything else besides, is something that should be avoided at all costs. And our British chambers in Europe are just as keen for that to happen as are our members here in the United Kingdom, because this is a two-way trade and an important two-way market. Yeah. So that's step one. But step two for me really is seeing the TCA a bit like the green base of a Lego set, if you've ever gone and built with Lego. It's the foundation. It's the base, right? And what you actually want to do at the end of the day is not just leave that base sitting there, but use it to build a building or some other fantastic creation. And that is what the UK and the EU are going to need to start to do. And in doing so, if, you know, I'm being a very optimistic person by saying this, you know, looking at this from our current vantage point, but if you can build on things, in that way, you could create a better trading environment for businesses on both sides. I'll give you an example. Scottish seafood businesses who are now facing those structural and permanent issues about whether they can actually send their products to key markets in Madrid or Paris or Rome or wherever else it might be. If the UK and the EU stuck a little Lego brick onto the base of the TCA, which was some form of agreement on SPS issues that goes beyond the baseline, then in fact, some of those issues, some of those problems may lessen, right? You've got the ability to build something on the base of this agreement, and I think that's what we should be doing.
It's interesting. I mean, I think that the sort of challenge to that is it doesn't feel like there is the political will, or at least the political environment now, to do that, and I think it's going to be definitely a challenge, I think, for your successor to try and persuade the government that this is worth pursuing. I mean, do you have any views on that?
We're only 3 months in to this new relationship, and invariably there are going to be issues to be diffused and unexpected consequences and twists and turns to deal with. The reason why I appeal for pragmatism, positive collaboration, calm handling of issues, and focusing in on the detail is because that's how we build trust. And trust is what we need. It may appear from this vantage point 3 months in like it's at its nadir, because there are issues between the two sides, very definitely. But that doesn't mean it's a goal that's not worth pursuing. We are out. We are going to be doing things our way. All of that is true. That is our next step as United Kingdom. But that doesn't impede us from building a relationship of trust and looking for new forms of collaboration with our near neighbours.
I like your appeal to sort of cool heads and rationalism, and I hope that is what prevails. I mean, you talked actually about the sort of doing things differently and how we might do things our own way outside of the EU. And I think already we've sort of seen a flurry of proposals for regulatory reform. I mean, from your perspective and this vantage point, do you think it's an exciting time for business? Is this a good chance to possibly cut some of that red tape? Or do you think it's sort of too much too soon?
Well, look, I don't subscribe to the old school way of looking at regulation, which is you look backwards at the statute book you already have and see what can I cut out of this, because that's what's really going to make business fly. It's just not true. Our businesses are very clear. It's not about what's already on the books that they've already adjusted to. It's about how we approach the sectors of the future. How we approach new technology, how we approach some of the emerging areas of business, which are incredibly exciting opportunities, and could we be the best place in the world to start and grow those businesses? So for me, the argument about regulation has got to be about looking at the future, not about looking at the past. We should be the best and most nimble jurisdiction in the world for emerging sectors and future technologies. Linked to that, we should assemble the best stack of global free trade agreements that we can. And when I say stack, what I mean is trade agreements that don't just, you know, notch up another one, 70, 71, 72, 73. It's not numbers. It's how they fit together and whether they fit together in a way that helps British business trade in global supply chains. And we should move towards a more risk-based approach to some elements of regulation and economic management as we look at those future sectors too, rather than sticking with the precautionary principle which we've inherited from the past. So for me, change in regulation is about how we approach the next phase of our economic development and growth, not doing red tape challenges for what came before.
And do you think the government's ready for that? You know, is sort of approaching it in that way, or do you think there's still more that they need to do to think in that sort of forward-looking way?
Well, I think invariably there are some bright patches where you see that already. If you think about the UK's, you know, post-2009 financial services regulatory regime, it's been really open to emerging technology and really open to bringing fintech into the equation. And as a result, we actually are quite successful in that space. And there's a constant conversation going on, whether it's through Lord Hill and Lord Khalifa's recent reviews Hill and Khalifa reviews and other things as well. All of that, means that we are well placed to regulate well in that particular space. There are others probably where we're less prepared, and there are others where we don't know yet what the sector is where we're trying to talk about. Mm-hmm. But the way we can become, you know, ready and really have the known unknowns on our radar is by planning ahead as a country. Mm-hmm. Now, we are singularly horrendous at this, in my view. So I've been through 7 business secretaries, 5 chancellors, 4 prime ministers during my time at BCC. I've seen hundreds of strategy documents and announcements, most of which have gone undelivered because all of the effort has been going into creating the strategy or creating the announcement rather than the execution, right? Mm-hmm. I would like one strategy for UK economic direction to 2050 and then a complete change of focus from writing additional strategies to execution, execution, execution. That's where we have to grow up as a country. And that's where both whether you're talking about regulation or whether you're talking about the enabling steps that government takes to help businesses, consistency will deliver results.
No, I think that's so fair. I mean, I know that I was talking with colleagues the other day about how many different funds there are available at the moment for things like Levelling Up and how confusing all of that is. So I think sort of having one clear overarching strategy is definitely the right step. I mean, if we sort of, I guess, move on to move on from Brexit and maybe talk a little bit more in detail about the COVID response. I mean, I'm quite interested, like, again, in your sort of overall view of how you think the government has sort of supported business through the pandemic. You know, have the support measures been sufficient? I mean, what's your sort of general take on how the government's responded in that space?
Well, first of all, when the pandemic struck in earnest in this country was one of those moments where the government realized it couldn't just listen to business. It needed to both listen and hear at the same time. And we at the Chambers of Commerce, together with some other business organizations, really ended up at the heart of thinking about what the immediate impact was going to be on business and what then needed to happen in order to support them. So my view is that success in this space has many mothers and fathers. A lot of people contributed to getting support in place. But, you know, we were all out there saying cash flow is the issue. Forbearance is going to be required on tax payments. Loans and grants especially are going to be needed in order to keep businesses that are closed going. And employment costs generally are one of the biggest things on any business's P&L and are going to need some very, very serious attention. And so when we talk about the furlough scheme, when we talk about the grant schemes in all four nations, when we talk about the COVID loans programs, et cetera, we can see our imprimatur there and say, we helped to build a really important support package for businesses through what has been an unprecedented and incredibly difficult time. But there have been some bumps along that road as well. One of them is there was a period of time when it felt to us like support was coming in a start-stop fashion, which led businesses to be unable to plan. And we campaign endlessly to say you need a long time horizon on this support. We know it's going to cost a lot of money and that we're going to have to repair the national balance sheet thereafter. Mm-hmm. But if you don't do this, you don't have the engines of wealth creation that can then pay back that debt. Because you will lose them. Yeah. And it took a while to win that argument for support over a long term. It kept coming in 4 or 6 week chunks or dribs and drabs rather than one consistent and coherent program. And so I felt some significant satisfaction when the Chancellor stood up at his budget at the beginning of March and said the support schemes continue through to September and in a few cases through the financial year as well. Because that's exactly what we'd been saying. It should have happened earlier. It should have happened sooner. Because that way you remove one source of uncertainty and allow businesses to focus on restarting and rebuilding their operations.
But no, that's really interesting. I mean, one of the other things I think at different times we've seen people call for or criticize the government for not considering sort of sector-specific support, sort of recognizing that different sectors have been impacted in different ways by the pandemic. I mean, what's your view on whether sector-specific support is something the government either, you know, should have done or should consider going forward?
I've had a difficult time with this particular question because I can see the merits on both sides. Economy-wide support means you don't lose out those businesses in supply chains, say, that could have been faced a shutout from support if it had been very narrowly sector-based. So I take the hospitality industry as a case in point. Personally, I think the hospitality industry has gotten a huge amount of attention and support because it's so very obvious to all of us. We all literally touch, taste, and feel the hospitality industry and deeply lament its closure. What about the ceramics companies making the crockery and cutlery and various other things for the restaurant industry? What about the food suppliers into that industry, et cetera, et cetera? They're not classed as hospitality businesses. They would have been excluded from a sectoral support scheme. And indeed, many were from some of the business rates reliefs and other things. Besides, even if 100% of their customers were actually in hospitality. So that's the difficulty of very narrow sector-focused support. So I've been very supportive of the whole economy approach, I think, for much of this period. If it comes to pass now that we're able to reopen much of the economy, but there are a few areas with continued problems, the case for sector-based support for those sectors with long COVID, they effectively have long COVID, don't they, begins to grow. And there in particular, I think about aviation and aerospace and their supply chains, who are facing quite a long build to get back to where they were in before the pandemic began.
No, that's really interesting. And I think the sort of distinction between what's happened so far and then, as you say, as the sort of opening up happens, but we see the impact from different sectors becomes clear, then maybe different responses will be required. I mean, related to that, I mean, looking back at the last year, I mean, the level of government support for for an intervention in business has been, I mean, extraordinary. Looking ahead, I mean, should the government return to how they were approaching this before the pandemic? Or do you think a sort of different model of government support and intervention is a better way to approach supporting the economy and recovery?
Well, government definitely should not return to its pre-pandemic model of business support, because model would be far too generous a term to use for it. It's been a patchwork of ever-changing, unstable interventions, many at the whim of specific ministers of all political colors and guises, that send everyone running in one particular direction and then get changed or cancelled 6 months, a year, or 2 years later. The pre-pandemic model failed my principal test, which is, I call it the 1-5-10 rule. It takes businesses a year to hear about something, 5 years to engage with it, and 10 years to really feel confident with it. That rule is behind the success of things like the German apprenticeship system, for example, which hasn't been changed in 70 years in very substantive ways. And it's behind many of the things that businesses feel are part of the furniture and that they can work with over time. We never get there. And so the UK's current, pre-pandemic business support model is not one to return to, no. When we look ahead, though, to a post-pandemic world, one big thing that's going to have to be considered is how do we deal with problem debt and how do we recapitalize a lot of our businesses? Many companies will be able to struggle on after this, but find themselves having great difficulty paying down the debts that they've accrued in order to keep going and stay in business. So recapitalization is going to be a very big theme. It will not go away. It will come back, even though the Treasury has not had particularly open ears to it to date. And so too will be the agenda around how we help individuals in our towns, in our cities, in our communities make the shift from jobs that they thought might have been around for an extremely long time into entirely new sectors because their old employment and old ways of doing things simply disappear. So a consistent approach to retraining and reskilling people is also going to be absolutely essential.
And is this also when the sort of the impact of Brexit is also then layered on, where, you know, you might have some businesses which have struggled through the pandemic, but, you know, without Brexit happening, could continue to be viable once things sort of return to normal, I put in inverted commas, because what we don't know what normal looks like right now. But actually, the impact of Brexit means that they are no longer viable. And actually, that there's going to be a sort of trying to understand how the sort of pandemic and Brexit intertwine and impact businesses will surely be quite tricky. And should that impact how the government then thinks about how it sort of engages and supports businesses?
I think it's really hard to know what the interaction of those two massive changes is going to be for individual businesses. Some firms I talk to say there's no 1-2 punch here. That's something that observers of business think is going to happen, but they're not so sure that it will. Others that I speak to are absolutely convinced that when you put the two things together, it leaves them in an incredibly challenged position. So there's a variety of views on that. I'm afraid this is one of those things where 5 to 10 years of hindsight is going to be required in order to genuinely understand how the two interact. Many of us can opine about it now, but with no more certainty than any punter on the street, quite frankly. It's going to take time to tell. I've always been one of those who've argued that the end of the UK's membership of the single market and the customs union was not going to be something we'd feel overnight. It's something that we'd feel over a 5-year period. I still think that's very much the case. And so too then with the pandemic and the recovery we've got ahead. So we've got a bit of a waiting game ahead to understand how the two interact and combine.
Yeah, and I mean, and do you think, you know, from, I know you're sort of ending your tenure at the British Chambers of Commerce, but in terms of how the role that business groups can play in trying to navigate that and try to work with government in understanding those impacts. I mean, how do you, what role do you think that the business organisation should be playing in the next year or so?
Well, the Chamber of Commerce Network, without a doubt, is the preeminent player in that space. And I say that not because I want to elbow aside any other business organizations, but because it is the only business organization that genuinely understands what's going on the ground in every geography across the UK, and indeed in our international trade flows with markets across the world. Because we do this stuff. We don't just opine on it. We do it day to day as part of our core business. So I think there is a great role for the BCC, for our accredited chambers of commerce, and indeed for other business and trade organizations as well. What do we need to bring to the table? First of all, we need to bring data and evidence. We have it. We share it. We need to keep on doing that. And, you know, the BCC runs the biggest single private business survey in the UK. It's the one that the Bank of England and the Treasury use, looking at the future of the economy, and comes ahead of a lot of the key official GDP data. Things like that are going to become extremely important during the recovery phase. I think the second thing that we can bring to the table is real world case studies. Because whilst people in Whitehall understand data, people in Westminster often only understand real-world examples. And getting them to take a choice sometimes depends on understanding the impact on a business in their constituency. So bringing those real-world case studies about what is happening on the ground to bear is going to be hugely important. And I think the third thing that business organizations can do, and this is what the BCC has done on both Brexit and COVID, is go to government privately and regularly and say, here are the unintended consequences of policy decisions that have been taken, and here are the unanswered questions where, if you don't bring forward detail and help for businesses, you're going to see an economic impact. And having that constructive and private dialogue, rather than one necessarily that needs to be sprayed all across the broadsheets, is extraordinarily important. Because that is where the decision-making will actually have a positive impact, and you end up with a virtuous circle rather than a vicious one.
Yeah, no, that's a really helpful way of setting that out. I mean, on that sort of final point about the sort of private dialogues that are really important, particularly, as you say, during Brexit and COVID. I mean, one of the ways that I've sort of observed the impact of the pandemic versus the impact of Brexit is obviously Brexit was a political choice. And I think ministers have, particularly under Boris Johnson's government, been very keen to demonstrate and say this is going to be a positive thing for the UK. And as we've discussed, there are going to be some opportunities and we'll see how that works out. I'm not sort of making a judgment on that point. But there's sort of been a bit of a refusal to acknowledge that there are also costs involved. Whereas if I compare that to something like the pandemic, where, you know, this is out of anyone's hands, this is completely unexpected and it's impacted everyone. You know, have you found that the difference in those two crises, if we call them that, has impacted how you can engage with government over that, or sort of, I mean, what's your sort of reflection on the comparison and contrast between the two?
I think I'd agree with the assessment that one of these events was a political choice and the other was an unexpected global event. And that has created some differences in approach. But where there is a similarity and where I hope we can move the business-government-public relationship in future, particularly in the face of future crises and events, is to learn that honesty in communication, that not negating the pain or difficulty or problems faced by another is a good way to connect with both businesses and the wider public, that boosterism and optimism, whilst useful in some perspectives, in others, actually removes attention from the issues still to be resolved. Honesty in communication, calmness, and acceptance of different viewpoints has got to be at the core of how we approach crises in the future. And any leader will invariably take a lot of flack for the decisions that they ultimately end up taking. But none of them would face trial in the court of public or business opinion if they communicated honestly, respectfully, and clearly with the public. And that's something, regardless of political party, regardless of level of government or anything else, that we'd like to see right across the spectrum.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point, and I would agree with all of that. I feel like we're running out of time. I mean, the one other thing that I was going to briefly ask you about, so this is jumping sort of away from Brexit and COVID, and maybe this can be the sort of final question, is about the government's recent publication, the Plan for Growth. Now, this is the Industrial Strategy Council, which I know it was its sort of second report, I think, and final report that was published last week, was pretty critical of some of the aspects of the plan. I think particularly that it was so centrally driven. And I'm interested, as you mentioned, BCC obviously does have quite an important role on the ground across the UK. So you've obviously got a sort of sense of the sort of local side of what's happening at the moment. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, what you think of the sort of the approach the government seems to be taking. And I mean, do you think it does undermine some of the existing partnerships with local authorities, mayoral authorities, and sort of the private sector to actually tailor improvements to the needs of local areas? So quite a big last question, but I would be quite interested to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I was extremely dismayed to see both the disbanding of the Industrial Strategy Council and the rather casual removal of references to industrial strategy from the government's lexicon in recent weeks. Why was I dismayed? Not because the industrial strategy was perfect in any way, shape, or form, but it had just about reached the 5-year mark in my 1-5-10 rule, a year to hear about something, 5 years to engage, and 10 years for businesses truly to feel comfortable with it. We were starting to get somewhere. And right as we were starting to get somewhere, even if it's just in communication, government has decided to reinvent the wheel, put new badges and names on things and change the approach. So I was dismayed by that, I have to be very honest. And I have great concern that the plan for growth uses the word plan rather liberally. Because in reading through it, it seems to me to be a series of commitments and actions, all of which depend on the execution of other and additional strategies and conditional finance decisions to be taken down the road, etc. And that did worry me, I have to be honest. From the local level, concerns have come up about local industrial strategies. People have worked for years to try to say, what are our specialisms in our area? And how do we, local government and the business community, work together in order to try to improve our capacity in those areas? And that would give us the best chance in our local area in order to level up, for example, if our economy was lagging others around the country. They were left hanging and wondering, now what do we do? So these sorts of changes have got to be well-trailed, well-communicated, well-planned, and demonstrate how the golden thread actually runs through. What are the things that we were doing yesterday, that we were doing a year ago, that we were doing 10 years ago, are still there and still going to be at the heart of our approach? And I suppose the way I think about it, because I think about this from the business perspective, is I think the three problems that we have in the UK are the same when I started in 2009, when Gordon Brown was Prime Minister and Peter Mandelson was the Business Secretary, right through to today, right? We have a human capital problem, we have a physical capital problem, and we have a financial capital problem that stops us from growing at the rate which we would like. We're not great at upskilling and training. We're not great at providing the infrastructure that's required in order to keep the economy going. And particularly if you're outside the M25, we're not great at providing growth and scaling finance to great businesses who often then end up getting sold. None of these problems are new. A lot of them have been around for a very, very long time. If we could just have one approach and work on solving those, and if government to government, we could have a sort of pact of state where we said, we're not going to throw out what others have done before. We are going to look at how we build on it to maintain some consistency for both business and the public. I think that would be a great approach. So we've got the plan for growth now. Let's get the detail on it. Let's understand how it can actually be delivered. And let's focus on the execution. and trying to get somewhere rather than moving on to the next announcement or the next strategy.
Brilliant. Well, I think that's definitely a good note to end on. I think the sort of the inherent short-termism in British politics, I think it is one of the big issues we're looking at, particularly when we're thinking about some of the huge challenges that are facing the UK, sort of not just the business community, but thinking about things like climate change, social care. You know, there are a lot of issues that actually need to be taken, have a sort of longer term look at, I think, to try and find some resolutions. But anyway, I think, you know, we could talk about this, I'm sure, for another 20-30 minutes. I know that we've already gone over the time that we promised. So I'll just say thank you very much, Adam, for joining us. I think there's clearly quite a lot for BCC's new Director General to be getting stuck into, Siobhan Haviland. So good luck to her as she tries to sort of guide the government to actually putting in some detail on that plan for growth. And also thank you very much to everyone who's tuned in and for listening. At the IFG, we'll also be continuing to follow the impact of Brexit, the economic recovery over after COVID, and also the government's sort of plan for growth and how that unfolds. So please do look at our website for more analysis and tune into more of our IFG live events. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you've enjoyed this edition of IFG Live. Please do subscribe to hear more. And if you'd like to know about our upcoming events, please visit instituteforgovernment.org.uk/events.